And welcome to the fifth estate. I am Varuni, your anchor for the day, and I will be helped in anchoring by Atreya. It is my pleasure to virtually welcome you all to Fifth Estate, which is an initiative by the Corporate Interface Team of Journalism Division of Symbiosis Institute of Media and Communication. SIMC was established in the year 1991 as Symbiosis Institute of Journalism and Communication. After 29 years of its establishment, SIMC's journalism program is the Institute's longest running program. The college has produced some very fine journalists, with several alumni winning India's most coveted journalism award, the Ramnath Goenka Award for Excellence in Journalism. The college has been constantly ranked in the top five media colleges in the country by several leading publications, which we are extremely proud of. SIMC has always been a pioneer in adapting to changes in the field of media. The college has been promoting newer and inventive ways of learning journalism and business of media in general. Amid these changing times, the media landscape is changing in unimaginable ways. And to keep up with this, it becomes extremely crucial to engage in conversations surrounding the topic of media and entrepreneurship. Journalism now constitutes the fourth pillar of democracy, and it has witnessed a paradigm shift where it has become the fifth estate, the voice of truth amplified, which essentially is what we will try to delve into in today's session. Therefore, in today's event called Transcendence, it is our attempt to understand this tricky relationship between entrepreneurship and media. We shall explore the various opportunities that young and aspiring journalists like us have in the digital world. And we will also be looking at the challenges that content production and making money through it involve. Thus, our today's discussion will be centered around media entrepreneurship and in today's essentially virtual world. But before we hear from our speaker, I request our director, Dr. Ruchi Jaggi, to kindly address the gathering, if you may please, ma'am.
Thank you, Varuni. That was such a brilliant start, Varuni. You just encapsulated not just the journey, but the context of why it was important to talk about how the journalism program, the longest running at SIMC, has tried to keep up with what's happening around, but also trying to make sense of what's happening around. So I really appreciate the effort that you put into writing that introduction. So that was really nice. I welcome, on behalf of Symbiosis Institute of Media and Communication, Mr. Prakhar Gupta, who is the speaker for this session in the evening. And it is fantastic to see the theme of this year's Fifth Estate. If I'm not wrong, Sushoban, this is our third year of the Fifth Estate, right?
Yes.
It was 3 years ago that the Journalism Corporate Interface Team, rather than it just a seminar on some contemporary topic, came up with this very, very provocative and meaningful title for this series that would happen every year, and rightly the Fifth Estate. Because as the fourth estate that media was very traditionally, conventionally referred to, continues to crumble under so many pressures, it is so important for the media to introspect and look at itself, and therefore the need of a fifth estate. In the digital and the virtual context, how we look at it as fifth estate is something that gives it another dimension altogether. And what the theme for, you know, Fifth Estate this year establishes it, also, you know, adds one more dimension to interpreting this phrase, the fifth estate, you know, because we are thinking about something very fascinating this year, which is entrepreneurship and media entrepreneurship. And I'm excited that this is a theme that came up from within the student group, because it also speaks volumes about how you are thinking about your own journeys, where you are looking at learning about new things, new practices, new crafts, and young people like Prakhar, who then become, in that sense, symbols and exponents of that inspiration for all of you and for all of us also, at the institute to introspect and see how our curriculum can go up to even delivering the kind of things that, you know, such motivated young people like Prakhar are doing. So as excited as you may be, I am as excited about attending this session. My sincere compliments to the CIT team, to every student who is attending it, to Sushoban for carrying it forward, to our IT team for seeing everything through in the current circumstances, for pulling it all off so well. We were hitting December, and I kind of was having like some sort of an insecurity that, oh my God, Fifth Estate should happen this year. Why hasn't it happened? And I'm glad that we will close the year on this note. So welcome everyone to this session. Welcome Prakhar to this session. And I think we're all excited to hear you now. Like I said, it's always exciting to hear somebody whose voice you've heard so much, and now you can see them too. So we're looking forward, and thank you. Yeah.
Well, I'm thank you so much, ma'am. I'm hoping my the way I look compliments the way I talk. I'm hoping it's not too much of a disappointment.
Thank you. It's just amazing to see you. Great.
Thank you so much. I think the team is called CIT, if I'm not wrong, right? Thank you so much for putting this together. I do understand that this is a bigger deal for my grandfather than it is for probably all of us here, and I'm glad that I could make this happen. Thank you so much, Sushoban sir and Ruchi ma'am. I'm glad to be your guest today. So, from what I understand of everything I've heard up until, it seems like of the three words that go in the title, exploring media entrepreneurship seems to be the heavyweight puller kind of a thing. And well, I did not prepare anything for entrepreneurship at all. So I'm going to let that be handled when the questions arrive. I'm more than happy to answer anything entrepreneurially. When that arrives, I think I have something more pertinent, more important, something more closer to my heart that I want to talk to you guys about. And
Mr. Gupta, I hate to stop you like this, but I would love to introduce you before we go ahead.
Please, yeah, go ahead. Yes.
For our attendees here. Okay.
Right.
Now, without further ado, I would like to introduce our very talented speaker for today, Mr. Prakhar Gupta. Prakhar Gupta is a creator dabbling between conversations on politics, history, books, art, and almost everything bizarre, which poses a chance to intellectually stimulate the human brain. His podcast, PG Radio, presents weekly episodes of such conversations, which also feature as video podcasts on his YouTube channel with the same name. With a place for hours of intense discussions, he also gives gyan on life, personal growth, and millennial issues on his another YouTube channel called Prakhar Ke Pravachan. He has just started Raw and Real Talk with fellow YouTubers Shwetab Gangwar and Vedant Kaushik. Currently, Prakhar is a Dean's List student, which is a distinction for his academic achievement as a student of economics and psychology at Columbia University, New York. While he has studied accountancy, finance, and corporate law, he is also a teacher at the Avalon MetaPro League with an ongoing course on personal development. With a dedicated viewer base, Prakhar is now nearing a year of his journey as a creator. And I think with that, we are all set for Prakhar Ke Pravachan.
Sure. That was all perfect, except the new Avalon Meta Pro League is professional development. I just want to be fair to them in case they have a problem later. That's fine. You were wonderful. Thank you so much, Varuni. So Prakhar Ke Pravachan, PG Radio, all that stuff that has come to be over the last couple of years, I think the instinct has sort of been the same. I think it's an intuition I've been chasing that I've now found the words finally to express. And that is precisely why it's so close to my heart. And I'm glad I get to address such a unique audience, such talented people, such motivated, committed people who pull together something so beautiful like this, even when the world's going really like to a different place altogether. So let's forget entrepreneurship for a while. Let's explore media, right? Let's sort of think of ourselves as, I don't know, independent Martians floating through this abstract media space. Let's think about that. And what I want you to consider as you take the word entrepreneurship out of the equation as a starting point is why something like PG Radio actually ended up working. Because the entrepreneurial element comes once there's a community, once there's a set of people around you, the entrepreneurial element occurs. What is more fundamental is why would a media enterprise work? Especially when there are what, over 400 news channels in this country, including regional languages. Why would something so bizarre, so a young upstart sitting for hours on YouTube talking about stuff that may not even interest the general population? Well, it does not at the first go. Why would that work? And I think what I figured back in the day when I started PG Radio was that there's a very important word missing from the vocabulary of all traditional media institutions. And that word is maybe. We've forgotten how to say the word maybe. We've forgotten how to answer the question, how much? How much do I think X is the case? How much do I think Y is the case? What is the probability assessment? How? I would wonder, sitting on the outside, watching people on the screen, left, right, center in America and in India, I'd wonder how the hell were they so sure? And forget them. How the hell were my friends so sure about stuff? How did they know? I read enough books. I spoke to enough interesting people. I spoke to the best of professors worldwide. And even they would be humble enough without a camera in place to admit, well, I don't know. But why is it that the eyes and ears of me as a citizen are betraying me because it refuses to see anything but a binary? Why is that the case? And I think what I figured was that there is room for authentic conversations. I think this word authentic is going to be very important as you go on your journeys into this media sphere that you're all a part of. There was room for words like maybe and probably, and I think I may be wrong. And that word did not belong on screens where people were shouting over each other to make negligibly interesting points. That belonged somewhere else. Possibly YouTube, possibly Spotify, possibly all the other access mediums that, you know, have come to become available. And the reason why PG Radio works with a theme as simple as maybe at the core of its line of questioning when I approach somebody, no matter if it's a psychoanalyst or if it's a political historian or if it's like a just like a journalistic royalty like Tavleen Singh might be. The reason why it works is because the traditional media is failing. And I don't know how long all your million-dollar companies that run news channels are going to wake up to that. There's a very interesting anecdote I have from when I was in Chicago. I did not have cable TV all that while I was in America, except this one time I was in a hotel room in Chicago for some weird reason. And I was flipping through the channels and I watched something on CNN, and it's talking about the then president, still president, Donald Trump. And it's framing some instance in a anti-Trump way. Like, it's like Donald Trump is the worst person for doing that. I flipped the channel, it was Fox News, and Donald Trump's the best person for doing the exact same thing. And I'm like, how the hell am I, like a 24-year-old, supposed to make sense of this? Who the hell am I to believe? Why are the borders of narrative so thick that there is no overlap between what two prominent media institutions are saying? How could that be the case? And it's not just me. It's the community of people that have come around me, to some degree, even you guys, because you share interest in my vision. You understand that there is an inherent bankruptcy within the modus operandi, within the way these institutions come to work. There is an inherent flaw. We may not have articulated that properly. Even I may be doing a terrible job right now, but it's closer to the mark every time I talk about it. There is an inherent bankruptcy. They're no longer trustable. Your eyes and your ears betray you. Here is the simple fact about your political lives and your narrative lives about almost everything else, but political lives in particular. Your eyes and your ears are no longer trustable. What do you do about that? And I mean, it's not, my attempt is not to pinpoint specific individuals or specific news channels or specific media outlets or any of that. It's like, if you come to think of the system upon which media institutions are based in the present day, a purely capitalistic model where, you know, the more viewers, the more money. You'll realize when competition's enough, this is economics 101, when competition's enough, the only way you can make abnormal profits is by deleting value. Like, you'll have to find a way around. You are no longer incentivized to tell the truth. You're incentivized to sell the best drama. And that pressure is immense. There is over 400 news channels in India. Why the hell would somebody not dress up in an army uniform, hold a fake AK-47 and announce what happened in Pulwama on a news channel? That is how absurd we've fallen. Who's awake to that? Who's looking at that? And I see, it's so interesting. I see, for a great while, I would make this argument, one form or the other, to my family, to my friends, and they'd still go back to watching that. And it's in part a psychological reason why that would happen. You know, you're fond of the familiar. Whatever's familiar is where you'd like to be more, right? I understand this. But I saw, and I hate to say this, I saw my family slowly get eroded, rusted by what was happening in the news media. I saw my dad move from a typical media outlet to watching Discovery Channel again, right? Where it was like, I'm just going to watch some historical documentary or something of that nature. I don't no longer want to hear these people shout and tell me what to think and what not to think. And I'm definitely not saying state-controlled media is the way to go either. Like that's I don't think is a smart way to put it. We've seen what that does in our, like I remember sitting with this very interesting gentleman at Columbia Journalism School, Indian gentleman. I don't know what he works for now, but he's worked for some very prominent newspapers in India. And he was telling me the history, he was from Tamil Nadu, he was telling me the history of how media would run back when it was more socialist, where it was like state controlled in the sense of like the ads would be state controlled and some of the newspapers that still have ads that only the states put in. He says, you can't trust them. And I don't see a way around that either. Like if it's state controlled, you don't necessarily hear the truth. There is incentive for something else. It's basic economics. But the fact of the matter is, if what exists now does not work and what existed in the past does not work, then we have to look for an alternative in the future. And that alternative is emerging. That alternative is emerging. And I mean, I'm probably a no player in that zone, but there is a Dhruv Rathi, there is a Sandeesh Bhatia with Scoop Whoop, there is a Joe Rogan overall, right? Where it's become so sensitive that if he speaks to Bernie Sanders and says, I support Bernie Sanders, it's a matter of national discussion in America. That's saying a lot. He's just an old comedian sitting and talking to, well, whoever he wants to talk to. And here is my suspicion. It's a rather radical suspicion. It's something I'm almost nervous about saying, but here is my suspicion. As far as I'm in this industry, and as far as I'm concerned, I think the old guard is dead. They just don't realize it. I think there is no way to save that ship at all. I think we'll see an eventual phase out of the way news has been told to us all along. And I have good reason to believe that. I have, well, empirical evidence to believe that too. I hear from people across the globe about how they found that one particular question I asked interesting. I hear it from so many people. They tell me, you ask good questions. And I'm like, me, a 24-year-old who's never sat in a journalism class, asks good questions. There is XYZ amount of people out there doing interviews that have been doing it for longer than I've been alive. They don't ask good questions. That's a question I ask myself privately. Maybe they ask better questions. Probably my questions are just more honest. And I think we're looking for that over everything else. I think I'm sure you guys read Marshall McLuhan, right? Right, like I'm sure you come across the medium is the message. And I think the medium is radically transforming. The message, because there was a demand for the message to be changed, the medium is radically adapting in some sense. And I think that what that means is that the old guard needs to wake up, as much as it is something I'm trying to communicate to you youngsters and who'd go on to become people in the media space. I'm trying to do that to older, the old guard as well. Will wake up. You've got to find a way. I've spoken to several people who run media outlets who at some point shown interest in my show because they want a podcast division for like their media thing. And I'm like, this is like saying I want some kind of presence on the internet back in the 99. Yes, you do. You really do. You want, and it's not the podcast or the word, the podcast or the conversation. It's the medium, which is that honest, authentic, I don't know, maybe, probably kind of a thing. We can get into the psychology of that, but I think that's irrelevant. I think let's take somebody like a Dhruv Rathi, somebody like a Sandeesh Bhatia, and somebody like a Joe Rogan and try and understand what is happening. Well, on some level, they all emerge because the medium has essentially changed in a way where everybody has access to broadcast. Dhruv sits somewhere in Europe. Rogan sits now in Texas. Sandeesh is in Delhi. Well, Sandeesh travels a lot. And what they do is they do their own independent kind of fact finding. I don't have a better word for describing that. I think that is probably the best way I can bracket that phenomena, all three of them. right? I don't agree with any of them entirely. Some of them way less than I agree with the others. But when I look at that, I'm sure, or at least I'm more sure, that I can take this person at face value. Whatever they're saying, they probably believe it. They're not making it up. They're not making it up to feed something in me, right? And I think it's the access to broadcast, the fact that anybody could sit and do it, that massively transformed the way we approached media. Well, in the 70s, in the 80s, when there were no phones and no YouTubes and no Instagrams, when nobody could just get a picture of you and upload it wherever the hell they wanted to, there was no expose, there was no way of, unless there was an investigative journalist who's sitting down and figuring out who you really are, you could be who you wanted to be in public and in private. That option is no longer available. And the life that's going to die is the public, polished public life. It's no longer sustainable because we know what the reality is. People have shot you on camera doing that, and it's only going to happen more and more. You'll have to let go of that. One good example of that is Matthew McConaughey. That guy, A-lister, Hollywood, suddenly on all podcast shows. Well, he understands the relevance. He understands that he needs to open up to his audience in that way. And the other half of what has changed is the way people want the message delivered to them. And Dhruv, Sandeesh, and Joe play separate games on those accounts. Dhruv's very much like, I'll compress all the facts I can find. There is no way he can probably, you know, strip out the way he connects those facts together, which is as important as finding facts, by the way. But he's like, this is the set of facts and this is my conclusion and that's it. Sandeesh is like, you know what? I will make people forget there is a camera in front of them so they can be real for 3.5 seconds. Right? Joe Rogan's like, listen, I'm going to talk to you for an hour before you forget that your opinion is anything more than this conversation. And then let me see the real you. And people are instantly like, I want to see that. I want to hear that. When, I don't know, there was some comedian who announced on Twitter a while ago, he wanted to see Donald Trump before the election. Donald Trump and Biden debate on Joe Rogan. And that got so viral on Twitter in a matter of minutes. Because people were like, yes, let's see them talk like real people, not mechanic robots from the 1960s. Like, these are not Honda created machines that are 5 feet tall and then raise their hand, because that is what traditional media has come down to. It's come down to performance. It's come down to a performativity. It's come down to drama and all the, what's the word I use for it? I forget. Sensationalism and all that. It's come down to that because they want to hold your attention. Attention means money. The very incentive structure that is tied to that is well, messed up. So what I'm offering you with letting you know about this alternative that exists is a kind of a liberty that I don't think everybody who I tried to tell this to when I was starting this off realized. We very rarely in your lifetime, in my lifetime, have moments where there is an entire makeover of the industry that is about to happen. What that means is that there is going to be some kind of a flood that is going to render the soil fertile. What that means is if you're willing to adapt, if you're willing to construct Noah's Ark, you're going to be left with a very fertile earth. And you are entering this industry at this fertile time. I am offering you the liberty to do what you love in the media space. I'm offering you the liberty to do what you love and do it publicly so you can find a community of people who love it too. I'm offering you the liberty to learn as you go. I don't think we as a culture understand what that means. We are so set on the idea that you need to remember your answers for your exams and then come and give those answers out. We don't have the idea of learning as you go and then helping others learn. I'm giving you the liberty to remain humble but assertive. I am giving you the liberty to prove the naysayers wrong. In my experience, I've always found naysayers to find a way to say no. They always have something to tell you. Oh my God. None of them know what really is happening. None of them care about you. None of that is happening, but they'll have a way to say no. The media space is changing forever. Forever. When we get to the question answers, I'll tell you how the entrepreneurial part of it works too. If there's questions along those lines. There is What I'll say is there's enough entrepreneurial part to not be worried about it. The cake's huge and uncut right now. You can have whatever slice you want, especially in India. I was speaking to Abhinandan Sekri once, and he was telling me about this paper he'd been either doing research on or using to research for his own stuff. And he was telling me the next 500 million in India that are going to come online are not going to read text because they may not be literate, are not going to have video because they may not have the bandwidth. They'll stick to audio. I am watching the podcast market explode in front of my eyes. This is just the beginning. Let people start drives back from like NCR into Delhi or like, you know, across cities like Pune and Mumbai, and they have 2 hours in the car to kill. Watch how slow radio died and watch how quickly Spotify moved from music to podcast. That's going to happen. There is no two ways about it. There's better people than me making the point. Dhruv Rathi is one of those people. Well, Sandeesh is one of those. Scoop Whoop is one of those people as a whole. Abhinandan's News Laundry is one of those organizations. For a while, their news podcast works very well. Things are changing and you are at the helm of it. What are you going to do? And that's all.
That was indeed very enriching and motivating. Borderline scary, not going to lie. The question that you asked, what are you going to do? It literally sent me into that thinking state of mind. If you don't mind, we have a couple of questions prepared.
I don't mind.
A little bit of entrepreneurial side of it. So, when working on podcasts, what are the main objectives that one should keep in mind so that it does not become monotonous? And a lot of people are getting into podcasting because it is simple. All you need is a mic and you just need some content. But how to not make that content monotonous and repetitive for your listeners?
Okay. Before I answer that question, let me not leave you at what are you going to do if it's going to be that scary. I'll tell you what you can do. Grab your reality by the collars and shake it till it makes sense for you. You know, if podcasting is really that easy, and I'm not saying all of you become podcasters. Right. Look into that option. Maybe that is what you're going to do. And it doesn't have to be news or media or like the stuff that I do. If you even begin talking about something as absurd as like, not absurd, but something as like esoteric as like kabaddi, you don't know the market for that. You don't understand how many people want to hear about it. I kid you not, if there was a podcast that was talking to soldiers in Siachen, you don't understand how curious we are. Right. And so curiosity is something that it sells very well. So that is what you can do. There is infinite options. What I'm telling you is that the market's going to break into something very new. Be at the forefront, figure out, experiment, and you'll catch hold of something. So to go back to your question of how to not make podcasts boring. Here is the deal. I think it does not get boring if you are not bored. I really think it's very reflective in that sense. Because I cannot make sure, I don't know who you are, right? I don't see your face, I don't see your ears, I don't know how you react to when I say something. I can't make sure. What I can make sure is my guest is not bored and I am not bored, that he or she's on the edge of their seat and I'm on the edge of my seat. How do I do that? Right? Well, I then ask myself the question, what are you good at? What is the kind of stuff you can do to hold their attention? Well, I can ask questions. That's my job, right? Okay, good. What kind of questions? And to me, questions that are important are questions that push the narrative beyond what they thought. Right? I'm there to make them think. I legitimately walk into a podcast thinking, how am I going to make this person think in a new way today? Just by asking questions. Because here's the deal, right? Say I'm speaking to an Amish Tripathi, and Amish has a certain view of the world. Well, Prakhar is 24, half Amish's age and barely experienced and whatnot. Prakhar has some other half-baked view of the world. If I ask him, Amish, I think this way, and I may be wrong, but I'd like to see how that compares to the way you see the world, he's more inclined to bridge the difference. In that process, he's thinking about something new. I am learning something new, and everybody else who had a similar doubt that they could not articulate is learning something new. I just became the voice of a certain amount of people. That is all I'm trying to do. I understand the skepticism one does or should have towards things that come to them. And I just try to voice it as it comes to me when I'm speaking to other people. So there is almost no way of not making it monotonous. I think the worst advice you can get trying to get into media entrepreneurship, especially of the social media variety, is make short content. Please don't do that. It kills all the value you could have become, inhabited, embodied as an individual. You are not a 15-second fun ride on a roller coaster. You are not that. You're the adventure park as a whole. Maybe that is a proper analogy. But the point is that it does not matter. You know, you've got to experiment. You've got to figure out what your style is. You've got to figure out what works for you. That is the independence you have. And that is what is scary about the whole thing. So for me, it's making sure that the other person had something to think about, that they forgot that time was a thing while I'm talking to them. So the questions have to be engaging. They have to be real questions about real stuff that matters really. And then a lot of it is also noticing how they're reacting to questions, very honestly. Because if I ask them a question and I see them in a way where I don't think they'll respond, I'll add something, or I'll pivot the question slightly, little bit towards the left or the right, or I'll put my response first so they feel comfortable about talking about it after, right? There is also a very interesting addition you can have in podcasts that I generally do not apply in the PG radio side of things as much as on the other, is humor. Humor humanizes people. If you hear, let's say, Modi ji laughing about a joke, it's just like a silly Hathi Sheeti joke. Think about that, right? You'd be like, ah, like, what a nice guy, right? Suddenly, the person's human and you are interested. They're no longer a machine. They're no longer a position. They're no longer a post. They're no longer Prime Minister of India. They're Narendra Modi. Suddenly become a different person altogether, right? So humor's good. In fact, even pushing on personal stuff, not in the sense of like personal life stuff, but personal stuff in the sense of not just my ideas, not just what I think, but who I am a little bit, right? That helps humanize people as well. When people admit to their failures, that really helps. And that helps. That's like a very common theme across podcasting genres, because the people are there for the real story. So failures have to form part of that. Right? But that's the general idea. You've got to keep the other person entertained and everybody else will fall in line.
With the storytelling being a competitive space, what are the essentials that go into the marketing side of podcasting? Marketing and production, rather.
Let's see. So, well, I don't market PG Radio a lot, so I might not use that as an example. PG Radio has always sort of been like a private university for me. I get to talk to people who are interesting, teach me stuff that I'm interested in, and that just works out like that for me very, very well. But here's the deal. Right now, nobody's listening to you on Spotify. Nobody's listening to you on Apple Podcasts or whatever, Chromecast or whatever different audio platforms exist. That's a very small market, especially because our eyes are free and our hands are not busy anyway throughout the day. You have to understand, the way people listen to podcasts is, say, if they're walking, they have their eyes and hands busy. That is the only time they listen to you. If their eyes and hands are free and they're just listening, they'll want to do something. And when they do that, they need that attention for that. They're going to stop listening to you. So right now, podcast consumption primarily in India is video, especially during COVID, especially because there is no culture of this. We've come to call podcasts are essentially supposed to be audio, not even conversations. They have become conversations and they've also been used to describe the video format of it. So what works is, you know, it has a lot to do with you setting yourself up on YouTube. Social media is a good way of still passing on the message. It is weird though, because social media just incentivizes for the wrong kind of stuff when it comes to podcasting long form, because social media is 15 seconds and all that, you know, and people also do not want to apply themselves when they're on Instagram. That's the harsh reality of things. They're like, wait, can I just watch a 15 second reel that makes me kind of smile because I think it's funny, but not something that's going to help me. So, which is understandable, fair, right? YouTube works better. People are more invested there. I think the only way you can sort of work your podcast from ground up, because I've known a few now, is collaborating with people who are interesting and important and untapped. And there's a huge market for that. I have lists upon lists, like all sorts of professors and all sorts of like scientists and, you know, travelers, like conspiracy theorists. You'll find everything. You'll find everything. Especially in India, you'll find a lot of variety. So the collaborative part helps. It's also the relatability aspect. So the three different things you mentioned that I have in order of popularity are PG Radio on the least, Prakhar Ke Pravachan a little more, Raw and Real just on a whole different planet. And that's because the relatability of content is an entirely different thing, right? So PG Radio is a lot of older people, especially the diaspora, that's very interested in that kind of conversation. Prakhar Ke Pravachan's younger people, India, Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3 cities. Raw and Real is just a whole different ballpark altogether. So it's a lot of that. There is other ways to promote this stuff in the sense of like, ads now cost nothing, especially on social media, right? If the attention's there, why are people not capitalizing on ads? I don't understand. None of the influencers that get made, influencers that talk sense, creators that talk sense, get made anymore without running ads. That's the harsh reality of it. Everybody I know runs ads. They have to. That's where the attention's at. So there's a lot of that, but it's a slow growing market. You just have to be patient. Twitter helps. Twitter has a lot of those folks that want to listen to podcasts, but you know, one thing that's very interesting with podcasts for now is that if you have an established log of listeners or just people who are influenced by you, like if you're say, like a Neha Dhupia started her podcast, right? It makes sense. She has people who know her and then who'd like to listen to her. Right. But for Prakhar, who nobody knew of, who nobody cared about, it's a whole different ballpark climbing that park because nobody's going to just like plug in earphones and listen to somebody they don't know. So there's an XYZ amount of ways. As far as production's concerned, it's not really that heavy. Honestly, all you need is an audio clip that goes up on like one of those aggregators. There's enough. What's the name? Anchor is now owned by Spotify. There's Simplecast, this is the one that I use, and you can just go there, plug in your audio clip, and it gets distributed across. So distribution's no problem. Distribution's no problem at all. Even production's no problem because you need Audible, fix audio levels, whatever, put the intro, outro, right, branding, and then just let it pass. So Raw and Real, which is now trending in India, we decided to make that audio 2 weeks ago. I don't even know how the audio files go up there. But it just works. So even that has no bearing on how well it will sell. It has no bearing on how well it will sell. You have to use social media to market it. You've got to find interesting topics and interesting ways to market it. And it's going to take a while because the market's still slowly opening. But it is opening. Like I've seen infinite amount of creators jump on the podcasting ship since I started.
Right. So I follow Prakhar Ke Pravachan and what I notice is that you have quite amazing opening and closing score. Apart from that, am I audible?
Yes, you're audible.
Hello?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sorry. So you have pretty amazing opening and closing score. Apart from that, there is this, there's a small gif that comes towards the end where you're standing like this. That is also pretty cool. So the amount of effort that goes behind making these videos, that is what, do you have a team or do you do it alone? How do you manage that?
Okay. That's a good question. I have a good answer for that too. So here is the deal. That's the old way when people would do everything by themselves is such an obsolete way of doing things, right? Like I still have a lot of creator friends who do everything from YouTube, get to go by themselves. And I'm like, oh my God. How long are you think your time is infinite? Do you think you can do everything? Like how long can you repeat this process? I think people underestimate the power of being bored. When you're bored, you're the most creative you can be. Like, trust me. And all of us have seen that. We switch on the shower and suddenly we're Sadhguru. We have all these epiphanies, these downloads happening in our heads. We have all these interesting ideas happening to us, right? That is the basic nature of how we think about stuff. So I don't think people keep themselves bored enough, especially these YouTube creators, because they design everything from the thumbnail down to the last second of the video. I never edit my videos. I never see my videos again. I only sat on one meeting with a music producer for the score. I delegate stuff I'm not good at. I delegate it. I industrialize it. I make it a process, and that happens automatically no matter where I am. So my family could be going through intense COVID and I could be occupied for a month, but the show will still go on. And nobody from my team has ever lived in the same city as I have. They're all distributed across the country. They're all a bunch of young people. The oldest person is me, and I'm barely like an adult enough to drink in New Delhi. And it still works bloody fine. It has no problem whatsoever. This is the new work model, I think. I don't know how sustainable it is, but it's been sustainable enough for me for this long, right? So people underestimate the fact that they can use social media as a full-time thing, which means they can invest in it with money and time, industrialize the process, make it faster and grow quicker. I grew very quickly because the entire process is set up. I've picked jewels for my team, and I've had them, like, they're trained in the right kind of stuff. It's so interesting, the enthusiasm I find when people want to join my team. It's quite, that's the most flattering part of doing this, is people wanting to be behind me. They're like, I want you to lead me into something new. And that's the whole point. You can create quite a phenomena if you were willing to invest both your time and money into this. So almost everything is delegated. Most of my content is just me recording. I'll switch on the camera, I'll say something, I'll send it, and the rest of it is done. I just have to coordinate. Then I'm free, I'm bored, I can think of the next big thing.
Right.
Thank you, Prakhar. That was a great talk. This is a sort of personal question. I'm also thinking about starting a podcast for last couple of years, and I tried to learn the technique, and somewhere now I'm motivated when you said that production is not a big problem, you can learn it on your own. But the question is, many times this may be something related to me as a person, that whether I'm eligible or whether I'm, competent enough to comment on things probably other people listening to that podcast or consuming my content are more competent to analyze. Let's say, for example, analyzing or maybe giving a review on a car, maybe. Maybe I've just driven 2-3 cars, but I think that maybe I'm eligible or I'm competent enough to, comment on a car or give a review on a car. But once I do it, I feel like, oh no, this is not, I think I'm not yet prepared to give out my opinion. Mm-hmm. And this happens with many such topics. So how do you deal with this internal strife that whether I'm competent enough, whether I'm ready or not? How do you deal with it?
Well, sir, here is something I'll tell you, which is very interesting about media space going into the social media world. It is no longer the first, best, only, or the most relevant, or the most charming. It's the most relatable. And the most relatable does not, like, look at your class, take the average, pick the most average student. Look at that person. That's a social media star who does not realize they're a social media star yet. That's the honest truth of it. So my point is, say if this is a bell curve, and you are not right at the center, you're not the average, you are, say, 75th percentile. Everywhere from 85th to 65th is your market. They're going to be happily in love with what you're doing. That's the whole point. As soon as broadcast and access is mine, only the people who want to listen to me will come. But so you could simplify it by asking yourself, how old am I? How many people of my age do I imagine, look, feel, talk, think somewhere roughly around me? That's your market. End of story. Or it does not even have to be like age-wise. You could just ask yourself characteristic questions. Maybe you are so-and-so age, but you feel younger or older or whatever, right? But I'll tell you something more interesting that will probably add. I don't know. This is just an interesting side note I have. So it's quite the opposite, I found. People do not want, it's not like people don't want you to be competent. They don't care how competent you are. They want you to make up your mind. And it's a horrible pressure on somebody as somebody like you and I, who are unsure of our positions when it comes to the cards that we're playing. Because the most common criticism I get consistently for PG Radio is, why are you sitting on the fence? Because I'm 24. That's why. I've had 5 years of, like, a mature, my prefrontal cortex is still a few years away from being fully developed. You want me to make up my mind about the future of the rest of the people in my country? How idiotic is that? People will constantly ask you to be like, you need to make up your mind. I don't care what your credentials are. If you're doing this, make up your mind. So it's quite the opposite. It's not like people are going to be like, oh, he does not seem competent. They're going to be like, what position do you take? I want to stand with you in the position you take. So I wouldn't worry about that. I would be, because when you say it's an internal question, it's also sort of a conversation you have with yourself, in the sense, well, how well researched am I? And I'd say, be researched enough till you're satisfied. Beyond that, let the audience decide.
Thank you so much, Prakhar. I think we will be opening the floor for questions now. We can have questions from the students, and I think the first question I see here is from Bhanu Garg. Bhanu, you can go ahead, unmute yourself, and switch your camera on and ask the question, please.
Hello. Am I audible? Hello.
Yes, you're very audible. Very audible. Yes.
Good afternoon, sir. That was a really nice session. I have
Thank
just
you.
One question. It pertains to you had said that how the new medium, how the alternate medium provides a space for a more transparent interaction or dispensation of news, if I might say so. That's what the question is about. So you at one point had said how the old guard is dying because it somehow got mired in dirty tactics. You then give an example of Dhruv Rathi to portray how people like him are using new platforms and that they constitute the future. But just taking him, taking an example of Mr. Rathi, like he himself started from the IT cell of the Aam Aadmi Party. And on multiple occasions, he's proven to have shown false messages and information. And he's doing that on mediums, I think he also has a podcast and on YouTube also. So, and he's doing that on mediums that you said are the future. And if I may say so, better at disseminating true news. Then is it really prudent to say that the various alternative mediums of communication are better than the ones which exist today? Would I be correct in saying that while TV journalism may not be tasteful, the alternative media space is also not free of its elements, these distasteful
elements? Oh, of course. Here is the deal. So, first of all, I have no defense for Dhruv. Like, that's not... I know. I'm just making it very clear. I'm making it on the record. There's something different about a corporation coordinating to do something and an individual bias, right? And I think that is sort of the difference. That's why it's more forgiving, or people are more forgiving of Dhruv than they might be of an NDTV or a CNN IBN. You see what I mean? Because Dhruv's also roughly my age, and he's just a boy and whatnot. And it's not to say, I'm not also going to make the case what is better or what is worse. Fact of the matter is that, well, in the economics of media space, there was a massive population that was unabsorbed by any supplier. There was a massive demand that no producer was satisfying, that Dhruv ended up satisfying. See what I mean? So it's not better or worse. It's like saying, was Facebook for the better or the worse back before Facebook was around? And you'd be like, this is a storm that's coming. Prepare yourself. It's not asking you. That's the direction of technology. That's how the markets evolve. So I'm also not sure if that's better or worse. I do think in some sense it's better, but it's worse in the sense that responsibility gets... I have no responsibility. You know what I mean?
True.
I have no responsibility. But also what is very interesting about what you said is alternate, the word alternate. And I probably missed on using that word throughout the conversation, maybe except once or twice, because I don't think it's alternate anymore. I really don't think this space is alternate as far as the international. I think it's very mainstream. I think Joe Rogan needs to stop pretending he's alternate media too. If he has weight over the elections of the United States of America, that everybody thinks probably Russia has on the other end. Russia, the biggest landmass of a country on this, you know, and then Joe Rogan, that bald, tiny guy. It's no longer alternate. It's mainstream. Dhruv Rathi is no longer alternate. He's mainstream. The real question is the medium is different. The medium communicates something different, not just YouTube or a camera in front of him with a green screen in the back, but the way he talks, the way his story has been building, his story as in the way he's been, you know, creating all the content that he's been creating. That's led up to a point where people have established credibility, reputation. They have an understanding of Dhruv and the way he talks. And that has more inherent credibility now or in the future as we go forward than probably your typical news presenters do. I think Satvik's a friend, the guy who runs Kupu. And I think it was him. I was one of these guys, or maybe it was Dhruv's. Somebody had posted a link of how many views they get as compared to a typical news channel in a month. And it was not even a comparison. It's not even a contest. When they started Scoop Poop Unscripted, which is where Sandeesh does his stuff, right? They didn't think it'd be a profitable enterprise at all. They thought this is going to be something that's going to be a cash leakage on their end. And I think Satvik talks about this on my podcast, and that they were going to have to feed it through their other enterprises, OK Tested, Scoop Poop, and this and that. Scoop Poop Unscripted does just phenomenally well for itself now. Part of it is owing to the personality of Sandeesh, I'm sure the business of Satvik and whatnot, but that tells you something. There's a huge space that needs to be absorbed. If I have, whatever, 16, 17,000 people waiting for the next episode whenever I upload it, and that says something. 16, 17,000 displaced people from the traditional media market space. Or the ex-traditional, at least.
Thank you so much, sir. It really was listening to you. Thank you.
You're most welcome.
Our second question is from Manya. I will go ahead and ask the question on her behalf. She says, hello, sir. Thank you for the wonderful session. Wanted to know what your thoughts are about the central government's recent decision to bring digital media and OTT under regulation. How do you think that will change the digital media space and the editorial freedom it offered?
See, I think there is just more than media to that question. There is economics, there is finance, there is technology, there is... So let me start off by saying this. No matter how strong the state's control might be, they cannot account for everybody who can broadcast views on social media right now. It's just too many people for them to really take care of, right? What you have to also understand is that it is not just India, but globally we are going towards this. Most of you are born in the late 90s, early 2000s, right? Right. In the early 90s, when we globalized and when the globalized world was going towards a peak, it's just so happened that we put our money down on the globalization table for too long. Globalization, 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 till it led to something like COVID. And not just COVID, but 2008 financial crisis. But not just that, is the Asian financial crisis, the blah, 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 blah. And we understand how fragile we made our systems. All big governments understand that we are dependent on others to sustain ourselves. And that's not healthy. That's not healthy in the long run because we are very susceptible to shocks that have nothing to do with us. Spain and Greece fell because America could not manage their bankers. That's very scary for a government, you have to understand, right? And so there is this wave of almost localist sentiment around the world. The media keeps putting it as a right wave sentiment. It's really not as much a right wave sentiment as much as it is save your own ass sentiment. Because nobody runs the world, nobody controls the grand narrative, things can go to hell very quickly, so be careful. And it's not just, I was reading about how the UK government is very unhappy about how the TV show Crown does not represent facts properly and therefore they want to edit it. And it's universal. The OTTs were alternate for a while, now they're the mainstream. And any government worth their salt is at least going to try and, you know, be watchful over it. How the tool gets wielded by the tool bearer, which is that how does the law get used by the central government and governments to come, is a whole separate issue. Whether it should be under the general regulation of law, I'd say I see no other way in the existing framework. Good or bad, better or worse aside, you know, as far as I'm concerned. But I don't see how they would not. There's more people watching Netflix than are watching Tata, than are using Tata Sky soon enough in India. Well, then what do you do, right? You've got to have some kind of oversight on that. And I think it was almost inevitable. So I don't know. I'm not a fan of, like, I fought very vigorously for freedom of speech back in America on Columbia's campus. I was one of the faces of very provocative organization that challenged almost all suppression of speech in any sense. And I got enough dislike, hate, shame thrown at me for me to then fall in love with the idea of freedom of speech, right? You backward invest into whatever beliefs you have and people are like, you're wrong. And I'm always skeptical. As soon as somebody says government regulation, I'm like, hold up. Also, you have to understand, part of my intellectual formativeness happened in America and those people are hyper paranoid about their governments. And I share that sentiment. I'm very paranoid about governments in general. Right. So as soon as there's a statute, I'm like, hold up. No, this might be like crossing a line when it comes to freedom of speech. But given the history of the Indian state, how it works, how it has worked, how it plans on working, I just don't see any other way. They would have gotten it now or sometime else. And there is a reasonable-ish cause for that.
Very true. We should always be skeptical is one thing that I think we should all learn in our lives, never to easily trust and keep asking questions. These will be major takeaways.
Yes. That's the general thing you should know. Like it biologically plays with us. Power is something that's just a whole different. But anyway, I'm sorry, I distract. Please go ahead.
No, please go ahead. We really like when you get distracted because then you come up with some amazing podcast. The other day I was watching this particular thing that you did for, I think, Prakhar Ki Pravachan, wherein someone spoke about the term spirituality. And they said that spirituality is basically spirit and ritual.
I cannot believe this thing will not let me die in peace. good. Ask the question.
It was totally hilarious and completely mind-blowing. How do you come up with such topics? How do you come across such people and the kind of things they say?
Well, it's on my face. Twitter's a dumb place. I can't help it. But that's what I meant. When I said my intellectual formative years were in America, you have to understand they're a very violent class of people when it comes to the idea sector of things. For instance, the vaccine acceptance in India is probably over 80%. Everybody's like, vaccine, haha, lagwa do, I need to go to work tomorrow. In America, it's probably near 50. You understand what 30% of Americans are? Paranoid. They're always non-trusting. And what that means is when they first encounter an idea, they strike it down and tear it apart. And that's what I learned. Quite literally, the 3 years I spent at Columbia was just exchanging ideas and tearing them apart. And I think that is how intellectual cultures should be. I think there is a reason why Shastrarth is buried at the heart of our intellectual culture. Debate, discourse. We may agree to disagree, and it's great that my culture, my ancient roots, acknowledge the fact that there could be many truths, but not without testing them. Because then bullshit gets smuggled into the idea of truth, and that is not okay. That leads to consequences that we don't envisage because we are too short-termed, we're too short-sighted, we're foolish enough, we don't think about things in that depth. And one bad idea stands for not just one bad idea, but the entry of the other 99 bad ideas, one of which could be catastrophic. Don't let that happen. Guard your ideas. They make up your internal life. They're not supposed to be frivolously thrown around and occupied because somebody sounds suave when they say that. That could be a Sadhguru, that could be an Osho, that could be bloody Donald Trump for all I care. Do not let bad ideas inside your head. I mean, they will come, but always debate ideas in your head because they will begin to then fester. You'll see that. Like, you'll see how, what is the word for it? Like, your thinking power will ferment in a very weird way. If you have bad ideas guiding you, if you don't check your ideas often enough, if you don't evolve and adapt time and again, especially for societies. And that's sort of the attempt. It's like, it's just on so many levels. Like, I think about that problem often, spirit plus ritual, because people don't let me off the hook when it comes to that question. Is spirit plus ritual spiritual? And it's like spirit plus ritual is as much spiritual as concept plus chul is conceptual. It makes no sense, right? Spiritual is anything of the spirit. As soon as you add the element of ritual, you have to worry. Because there's rituals like animal sacrifice done in the name of spirits that I'm not okay with. You see what I mean? Like, it's something as simple as that. Some people might be okay with that. Well, best of luck, no problem. But spiritual is, and then to just brandish something as neutral as spiritual to be absolutely the end all be all of your life. What the hell? That's just like a personal offense I take on bad ideas. But yeah.
Yes, Pradyumna has quite an interesting question, which I also had in my mind. Pradyumna, you can go ahead, unmute yourself and ask the question.
Hello, hi. I wanted to know that your podcasts have a lot of prominent guests. So how do you narrow down your choices and call the people and decide the guests for your show?
Well, the honest answer is beggars cannot be choosers. Well, thank you for that question. That's a good question. See, for the longest time, I think the first 20 or so episodes, maybe even 30, were just my friends. I'm very weird in that sense. I don't plan. I was like, let's go, right? Just picked a bunch of my friends. We'll talk. I'll put it out. I'll get in the flow of things. So it took 20 or 25 episodes before I got a decent break. I think the first one might have been like a professor here and there. I think it was a professor who'd actually been on Joe Rogan's show. So it was like a huge deal for me. He was a professor at NYU. I emailed him. He'd responded. But it's the same thing. I cannot factor in all the variables of the people who might be listening to me. So what do? I optimize on my variables. Who do I find interesting? What do I want to learn? What are the questions I have? And that's what I take it forward with. So when I spoke to Mr. Joseph Ledoux, the gentleman at NYU who does neuroscience of consciousness, emotions, memory, fear, he's the guy whose research all the pharma companies use to create benzodiazepines that are given to anxious and all that kind of like your what is that, Alprex. So Alprex ka jo salt hai, that's the guy who came up with the research that led to that. It was just honest, like I wanted to ask him. I was like, I have a feeling that I don't think Alprex or any of that benzo stuff works. I don't think it does. And he was like, well, I agree. I think they really mischaracterized my research to sell that drug. Right? And there is an interesting question and an interesting conversation waiting for you right after. He's also part of a band. Like, wait, how does this work? Like, when you're writing songs, do you think of neuroscientific terminology? Is it like medial cortex, blah, 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 when you're writing a song? And that makes for a funny question. He has a funny response, but it also elicits information. So fact of the matter is, it's difficult to get guests. That's the number one obstacle when it comes to podcasting. And I think a certain amount of charm that I inherited from both my mother and my father has helped me score some of the better, more smarter people to talk to. But it's really just that I hear about all these people, I see what they've done and what they've spoken about. And if I find it interesting, I'll be like, let's talk. It's as simple as that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're most welcome.
The next question is from Ayush Kataria. Ayush, you can also unmute yourself and ask the question, please.
Yeah, good evening, sir.
Good evening.
Thank you for the session. It was very insightful. I wanted to ask, like, how you spoke about how you choose your topics and all, but do you give attention to the fact that how much your audience likes it, or is it reaching them in the way you want them to, and how much do you let that affect what you are talking about or what topic you're choosing or who you're calling on your show? Or do you go by like on in your own instinct about like what you prefer, like how do you balance it?
Have you heard of Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky? Have you heard of the book called Thinking Fast and Slow? No?
Not really.
No, okay. So Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky were psychologists. Kahneman's still alive, Tversky is dead, and they won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1999. And that's quite a thing when you're a psychologist and you win a Nobel Prize in Economics for their work on something called behavioral economics. A new field was born because of their smart stuff. And what they were trying to tell was that the mind is not rational, the mind is not logical, right? That there is certain patterns we repeat that are absolutely irrational, but they're called heuristics, shortcuts. And one of those patterns called anchoring and adjustment. That's a good mental model to have if anybody's listening. I'd really suggest you understand anchoring and adjustment because you do it all the time. So what ideally should be done in a podcast setup is you anchor for the questions, this voice of me that I'm talking about. My questions, what I'm interested in, blah, 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 blah. And then you offer it an adjustment towards the audience average. You see what I mean? So you start from the selfish and then you adjust from there to the selfless. Well, the way anchoring and adjustment works is something like if you're thinking about the number 100 and if I ask you a question, you're going to think roughly around the number 100. So the adjustment is a smaller part. The anchoring is the major focus. You understand that. Okay. I, however, with PG Radio, discount the adjustment part almost entirely. I really don't run it for a commercial end at all. I don't want to. That's going to soil what I'm trying to do. I don't want the money involved. For now, I haven't figured out how to get the money involved without getting it soiled. Like, and it's not even just soiled, but it's also like the whole purpose of me starting PG Radio was for me to learn well beyond university, to have my questions answered. So I just don't want any distractions involved with that. So I don't adjust. But ideally, you have to adjust. To what degree? That you'll have to experiment and find. That you have to figure out how diluted, because if I did the same stuff I did at PG Radio or what I'm doing right now, which is probably closer to my potential, let's just say, I cannot run this by on Prakhar Ke Pravachan and expect it to succeed. People are just not going to be interested. Right? That's stuff too personal to Prakhar. So I need to adjust to the audience. I need to become relatable. I need to become approachable. I need to become a person that they understand and feel and relate with. That's the adjustment part. And it's a varying amount of adjustment. It depends on who you want to be, right? So let's see what would be a nice example. You know what, forget the example, but you understand, right? If you want to be massy and really popular, you will adjust to something, and that's just relatable, accessible, whatnot. In that fear, in that process, the fear is that you might lose who you truly are. You've adjusted too far from the anchor. So you've got to figure that out. You've got to figure the dynamics of it out. You anchor at yourself. That's the easiest. That's the most safe place. You know who you are. You understand how interesting you can be, roughly speaking. You're like, achha, theek hai, mereko pata hai, I'm interested in these topics. No? Okay, cool. Now, how do I adjust it so that more people can get behind this motion? So with PG Radio, I do nothing. Prakhar ke pravachan a little bit. Raw and real, actually nothing. I genuinely do not filter myself there. If you guys have seen that, I have zero concept of like what I should not say there. So yeah, that's
my the next question is from Atriya Raghavan. Atriya, you can please unmute yourself and ask the question.
Right. Good evening, sir. Thank you for such an insightful session. It's a question somewhat similar to Ayush's, but I mean, in addition to simply knowing your audience's tastes and preferences, sir, how far is it, according to you, important for a podcaster to incorporate all of those tastes and preferences in their content? I mean, how do you figure that out?
Okay, let's do a case study, right? Prakhar ke Pravachan is at 60,000 subscribers right now. As we are talking, it's somewhere right. Say there is a specific brand of tastes and preferences they have. At one point, it's going to be 200,000. That means more than thrice of what it is right now. All those tastes and preferences get washed away. Right? The new audience could have an absolutely different set of tastes and preferences. Fact of the matter is, you don't incorporate your audience's tastes and preferences into your thing. No matter what taste you incorporate, there's an audience for that. You see what I mean? You see the perspective difference. But here's something interesting I'll tell you. The audience that comes to you is the audience that has the same underlying beliefs, the same unconscious, the same unarticulated beliefs as you do. What I mean by that is, I never for one have said on my podcast or my shows or any of that, this is where you come to learn. This is where I help you grow. Do you want to grow? Do you want to become the best version of? I never say that. That's a given. So all my audience is pre-selected for that. They're there because they want to grow. I don't have to say that. So everything you don't say is what selects for the audience that comes to you. Do you understand what I mean? So it's slightly tricky in that sense. Say you're a fashion influencer. You never say dress well, look good, look great. You never say that. It's people who want to dress well, look good, and look great that are your audience. It's what you don't say that encompasses your audience. So because you're assuming this is the person I'm talking to, say I'm talking to Atreya, right? And I'm telling you, listen, you should meditate. I'm assuming the fact that you are somebody who wants to have a more relaxed, peaceful life. I'm automatically selecting for you. While Ayush or Ritwan, they don't want that. So they're like, kya bakwas hai? They'll flip the channel. Fact of the matter is, when you're starting, every act that you do attracts a new kind of audience. Every interest, taste that you incorporate attracts a new kind of audience. And eventually you become some sort of a taste leader. Because that's what influencing is, it's taste leading. That's how most influencers make their money. Oh, why don't you buy this product? This is absolutely a tasty product. And everybody's like, well, I should buy that soap because this random person on the internet told me to. So they're tastemakers of some nature, right? What's the name? That oldish lady with a boycott that does house stuff in America. I keep forgetting her name. She was in the prison for a while. It's kind of like that. Forget it. A bad example. But it's kind of like that. So, you'll have to. Maybe a better question to ask is, what amount of feedback from your audience do you incorporate? And it's usually not a lot. It depends on what you're trying to do. Like for an intellectual pursuit is different from a fashion pursuit, is different from a travel pursuit, is different from, right? But most of all, you have to understand, you cannot give the audience what it wants. That's a bad aphorism. I think a better aphorism is 80% give your audience what it wants, 20% lead them forward. They will respect you for it, they will stick around. Because when you say give the audience what it wants, which is what traditional media believes, which is what traditional YouTubers and this alternate sphere believes also, give the people what they want. People want heroin. They don't job. You see what I mean? You can't, people and markets are not the most responsible, like they're not responsible for themselves. If you've been chosen de facto as some kind of a leader, where is the responsibility? Where the hell is your responsible? Where is the ethical part of the whole thing? Give the people what they want. Oh my God, do you listen to yourself talk? So that's sort of what it is. It's you don't give the people what they want. You lead them forward. You show them a vision and you walk them towards it. You're a leader at that point. No matter what particular domain you might be a leader at. Maybe you're just fond of bangles, the different ways bangles are made in India. You're a taste leader in that domain. It's your responsibility to push people forward. It's your responsibility to help them grow. It's a community you're building. A community is not just people listening to you talk. It's people talking to each other, doing stuff within that domain, helping each other move forward. It's all of that. You cannot just let it be. So, you cannot listen to your audience entirely. You're supposed to be different from them. You're supposed to push them. You're supposed to be receptive. You're supposed to be receptive. They must feel heard. If they're trying to get in touch with you, they must feel heard. People miss that point so often, right? People, when I do my live streams on YouTube, I'll suddenly go to the, I'll be like, audience, OP this, OP that. Like, I'll just, you know, I'm making sure they're involved. They need to be involved. That's the reason why they're there, right? And there's, my existence is dependent on them. I'm there because of them. And I don't make them feel involved because the medium does not allow, right? So you've got to keep doing that. But you can't become what your audience, you'll be held hostage to your audience very quickly if you start worrying about that. That's a lot of people. Oh yaar, meri audience chali jayegi. I'm telling you, in this quote unquote alternate sphere, so many people are afraid ki unki audience chali jayegi. So they're now basically prisoners to their own devices. That's like, you created this. Ab tum khud hi ko isme lock kar loge. Because people prefer familiarity. People prefer certainty. People prefer what they know. And it's boring. And it's not sustainable. So that's the 80-20 ratio is also, by the way, Satvik. That's not me. I learned it from him and it's worked wonderfully well for me.
Right. Okay. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm. Shreya Kachru has the next question. Shreya, you can please unmute yourself, turn your camera on and ask.
Hello, sir. I just wanted Hello. To know that since this is such a competitive industry, so how do you draw the line between constantly monitoring the podcasting metrics as well as not letting it affect your craft and what you actually want to put out in the public domain?
Well, I never look at my podcasting metrics. I swear to God, if you even ask me what my last three episodes were, I don't know. I genuinely do not remember what my last three episodes were. The last one was with Ruchir and I'm blanking on the ones that were before that. I swear to God, because I don't have, there was one with Amish, but I don't have the time, right? It's, see, here's the deal. When you say it's competitive, this might be a little psychological. You say it's competitive. What you mean is, well, there's a competition between me and somebody else. There is another. You know why you say that? Because it's necessary. There is no scale in life. There is no inbuilt numeric system in your head. The only way you ascertain good or bad is by comparing. That's the default, the way you think. All industries are competitive. All industries have that element of you have to compare to think. That's the way your mind works. It's called a dialectic, Hegelian term. Now, if I can tell you that you could compare yourself to yourself yesterday, It'll make cliche sense, but not inspire you in that direction as much. If I tell you, be busy doing your craft, what you love all the time, you are automatically in that zone where you're only comparing yourself to yourself yesterday. And you are constantly busy. You have no time to look at the metrics. I have gone through the stage where I used to look at the metrics, does not help. Drove myself into absolute sad, just like helpless depression at one point because this is never going to work. I have been in a place where I had to unsubscribe from all the notifications that get off YouTube on my email because I did not want to read what people were saying about me. I have been in that place where I've actively just stopped looking at my YouTube. I do none of that anymore. It's irrelevant. I don't enjoy it. What do I enjoy? Doing what I do. So I have to make sure of two things. One, I get to do what I do. And two, I make enough money to feed myself doing that. That's two very simple problems. Trust me. I grew up playing chess. You know, the alternate speech I had in my head today when I was going to talk to you guys was about the nature of conformity, how you're programmed to believe there is one right answer. That's all you're testing throughout your life. You can't help it. You can't escape it. You've been programmed to believe, you know. My unique strength in that situation was I grew up playing chess since I was 3. And with chess, you understand there is no one way of finishing this game. Slight moves and you have a totally different board. It's a problem solving exercise where this is the resource access you have. This is the situation it is. Go solve. It's two problems you need to solve. Do what you love and make enough money doing it. And that's really not that big a deal. Trust me. So forget the metrics. It does not matter. Weirdly, vanity metrics work better to test how well you're doing. Like as soon as I had a meme page that was Prakhar's memes, somebody, random guy making memes about me, I was like, okay, good job. As soon as when I'm walking on the airport, somebody comes says, hi, can I get a picture with you? Good job. How many subscribers? Don't know, don't care. You see what I mean? Those are like small signals that will satiate you on that level where you want to understand how well you're doing without getting you involved in the weeds, which is where things get complicated. I have enough friends who run similar enterprises as I do who are constantly worried about numbers. You have no idea how, like, oh my God, the Instagram blue tick is such a big deal for people. It's astounding that a company's AI approval, mechanical approval from a company, which is nothing more than a tick on your screen on an app that may not matter in 10 years, is worth your life suffering. Like you're refusing to eat and interact with your family because you don't have a blue tick right now and you've been waiting for it for so long and you've tried everything. You've paid off news organizations to write articles about you. You've tried submitting it to Instagram so many times. That is how silly this whole thing is. It's a rat race. Anything that can be more will be wanted more by your head, by your brain. That's how your brain's programmed. Don't fall for that. Fall for what you love. It's the best way to stay sane.
Thank you, sir.
No, I mean, if the question's still not answered, I'm very happy to go on and talk about that because that's a very important question.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Sir, I just want to add to what Shreya was saying. Am I audible?
Yes, you are.
So, sir, you mentioned about the memes and all. So, how do you adhere to negative publicity as a podcaster or something?
Like I'm saying, man, here is a good hack for that. If you're setting on the individual path because there is no insulating corporation around you, there is no cubicles of offices and chairs and like other people around you to protect you from the stuff that comes your way. It's just you. And sometimes when you're the leader of a team like I am, it's you first. All the mistakes that my team makes are my mistakes first. Surround yourself geographically with people who don't give a shit about what you do, who love you regardless. Like my dad's not going to be like, "Acha, tune PG radio band kar diya, you are no longer my son." He's still going to be like, "Prakhar, mera beta," right? My friends are no longer going to be like, "Arey, you are no longer popular on the internet. Get out of my house." They're going to be like, "Oh, my friend," right? In my personal time, I never talk about work. It's so much more convenient. If I'm hanging out with friends and if one of them says something about Pravachan or PG, I'm like, "Yaar, can we not?" Because I don't want that there. There is so much else to discuss than stuff I do anyway all day anyway. Right? As soon as I'm done with this, I'll go downstairs. I was like, "Kya baat kari aaj fir?" I'm going to be like, "Sun lena na, abhi kya bataun main aapko?" Like you'll have the opportunity. I got it recorded, right? So that's what I mean. One of the things to save yourself from criticism is, one, don't look at it. But well, you'll have to for feedback sometimes. So you've got to develop a thick skin because you're leading yourself into battle. Be at least Achilles, if not more. Because you'll die, you'll be crushed. And two, surround yourself with a good team. People who always push you up. Well, the first few months of doing Pravachan were horrible. I remember just like calling up random friends and being like, "Dude, I don't even know what I'm doing. Is this even going to work?" And that doubt still remains, still comes from time to time. You've got to work through that too. Because when you work, all the imaginary constructs of doubts that are in your head fall first. All the irrelevant issues that your mind was brooding over fall, and then you can see the substance and solve it. The general point is, people spend too much time thinking about hate. And it's because we are programmed to do so biologically. We are biologically programmed to be more careful about negativity, hate. Fear is the base state. You have to program yourself out of it. It's an entire journey. It's great. You should watch Prakhar Ke Pravachan. I talk about that a lot there. But That's it. Surround yourself with great people. People who don't care about what you do, people who value you regardless of what you do, because you might fall for the trap of valuing yourself for what you do. And they'll remind you, listen, you're more than just your work. You're more than just what people may think of you from one episode. You're you, and it's great. You're alive, and that's great.
This is the last question that we have for you from the audience. Praveen, you can go ahead and unmute yourself. Please ask the question.
Thank you so much. So I would like to know, sir, how do you actually monetize your social media and Prakhati Pravachan? Like, what are your strategies and how do you actually like get your revenue from out of it?
Okay, good question. See, people will, how do I begin answering this question? It's sort of like this invisible index of how much have I given to people that allows me to assess how much I can take from people, right? We're speaking in transactional terms right now. This is not the essence of what I do. This is one way of looking at it, the transactional way of looking at it. I give people everything I can for absolutely free everywhere. For a very long time, for 6 months, I do that. People are very happy with me. Then I put out a product. Something behind a paywall. I do art of conversation. How do you talk to people? Supposedly I'm decent at it. People will buy that more than happy. They'd be like, I'm glad I'm investing in Prakhar. This guy's helped me so much. This is something people make a mistake in most of their social interactions and social life as well. They expect things too soon. Have you put that on the table first? Have you given them enough for them to feel safe to give it to you? So what I genuinely focus on, what my job is as far as content is concerned, is actually providing people value. My parents are professionals. My dad particularly is a very strong-headed professional. He's a chartered accountant, in training now a lawyer. And he would tell me, he's like, always give people what they're asking for free. All opinions, give it free. Koi dikkat nahi. They still won't know how to apply it. They'll come to you. They still won't know how to do it or some version of that. That's what I use. I give it for free. Everything's absolutely. I say it on record here and I'll say it on record elsewhere. Everything that is in the art of conversation is probably on my YouTube otherwise too. It's just compiled and better and precise in the art of conversation. And the art of conversation sells like hotcakes, by the way. It's amazing. Every day I wake up and my phone's cha-ching. With so much money. The course market, the mentorship market, if you do it honestly, there's so much money to be made in that market, if that's what you're looking for as a creator. The only stale market I have found in terms of making money as a creator is the sponsorship business, especially if you're like an average YouTube creator, like an average YouTube creator being you don't have a niche, like you're not men's products, face wash and whatnot creator who talks about men grooming, then you're a niche creator. If you're like somebody like who just does funny stuff, for instance. These companies are horrible and I just see them deal with you in a very like, it's like they don't care about the soul of your work. They don't care about the artist in you. They care about them selling. It's just not a good, that's just a mismatch. That's a principal agent problem. But there's courses, there's, if you give enough to people, they'll pay for your attention. They'll pay for your presence. They'll pay for so-and-so. My dad says, Naam kamao, nama aa jayega. Build reputation, build credibility. Money is going to follow. So the course market is how sort of I capitalize on stuff. There's the art of conversation. I put out something called the Happiness Manifesto, but that's practically for free. Then there is the Avalon Meta stuff I do, where I actually get to train students the way I want to train them. Then there is other plans I keep coming up with. It really is just, what is the value I can provide people? How would I provide it to them? And then there is enough of a market for that. I play in that domain. I play in the education domain out and out. There's other people doing variety of other stuff. Like there is there's a gentleman by the name Vaibhav Sisinti who does LinkedIn growth hack workshops of some nature. And I've seen some of the screenshots of that stuff. It's like 2,000 people. That guy's making more money than like probably the next 100 creators combined in a year in one workshop. If he's selling it to 2,000 people, that's a lot of bloody money, no matter how he's, and he's obviously selling it for like over 1,000 rupees. That's a lot of money. So there's that. the education sphere has a lot to offer. And I mean, if you understand how somebody like a Jake Paul or a Logan Paul do their stuff, if he's fighting Floyd Mayweather, think about the money he will make, even if he's like a 20% cut on stuff. Relevance will lead you to money. But here's a very important piece of advice for anybody who wants to get into the creatorship business. And this is also advice I got from Satvik. He said, it's very easy to create content and build a community. It's very difficult to monetize that and run a business out of it. It's not been very difficult for me, but it was good that I was aware about it from the get. That I knew that this is a possible complication I need to resolve from the very get. So I monetized early, and I monetized in my own way, where it was not like, hi, buy this face wash. No. Every time I get a sponsorship email, I'm like, no. Right? Might as well sell something I believe in, which is something I would rather make with my own hands than somebody else's. So when you're a creator, you are not really a creator or an artist. You are a node in the advertising network of things. You can advertise anything, and anything you advertise sells. So you make money. That's no problem. You just have to find the right product fit.
Yes. Thank you so much, Prakhar. This has been very enlightening. It has truly been an eye-opener. Some of the things that you said made a lot of sense. And as journalists or as people who would enter the changed world, I think making a person think with your questions and how you said that important questions push the narratives further and honest questions are so important. I think that is one major takeaway. Apart from that, you said some beautiful quotes like add humor to your podcast. And I love how you said humor humanizes people. So thanks a lot for that. I would now request our head of the department, Mr. Sushoban Patankar, to please address the gathering.
Right. Thank you, Prakhar. That was really a fascinating session, and there are a lot of things to learn. There are a lot of takeaways from your lecture, from your session, actually. And just to put it like a summary of what we spoke about or covered today morning and right now, you know, it is very important to have a story to tell. That's very important. Whether you know how to brand that story, how to promote your brand, how to make things viral, how to monetize those keywords and all those digital marketing things are fine. But as long as you have a story to tell, as long as you have that passion to tell a story, I think everything else will fall in place. That is something, the most important takeaway from these two very fantastic sessions. And as journalism students, there is one very important thing about these two sessions is that you really don't have to restrict yourself to, you know, those very conventional news media beats such as politics, crime, sports, or let's say fashion or something. Even if, let's say, you are in sports, you are interested in ISL, like I see Ritaban here. He's so passionate about ISL. Although I don't follow ISL, but people around his age group, they do follow ISL. I think he can definitely start a podcast around ISL, and I'm sure he'll get his own audience. And there is no age limit or a particular stage to start your media venture. And, now I really face a challenge here. Because for last two years in business of media, I used to teach this particular sentence that content is king and distribution is God. Now, the distribution is taken care of by, you know, the digital media, the internet. So I really have to talk about content is king now. This media economic space is actually changing amazingly, and that is good for all of us. Doing journalism or learning journalism and wish to do something in news media sector. These are definitely, you know, the future is really good. Today is definitely not a great day. Today, Mumbai Mirrors published its last edition. But there is something to take from this particular day, that conventional media probably is part of history now, but there is audience, there are readers for news content, and how to, you know, create, how to produce that news, how to disseminate that news, how to make it more interesting, how to make it more engaging. That is something all of you all can actually think about it and, you know, innovatively present that. And that is something we all can learn from Mr. Ibrahim and Prakhar. Very different sorts of genre of news they are into, and they are using different kind of medium to narrate their story and engage with the audience. So thank you, Prakhar, and also Mr. Ibrahim is not there, but thank you to him for coming for this session. And thank you all journalism students for attending these sessions. And I wish to thank and congratulate my CIT team. They did a fantastic job, led by Upasana Singh. Terrific, Upasana, you did well. And I'm sure now the team, next year's team, Pradyumna, can take a leaf out of it and maybe do something better than this. You know, we can go beyond entrepreneurship and talk about innovations next year, maybe. So that's how we take forward these conversations. That is very important. And I wish to thank Director Dr. Ruchi Jaggi for, encouraging us to conduct these sessions. Probably we were a little late in the semester, but okay. We did this was probably the grand finale of this year's CIT events. That's amazing, and I wish to thank the IT team for their very, very amazing support. And thank you all, and thank you, Prakhar, once again. Good evening. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been absolutely fantastic.